Blog Talk Radio.
Well, folks, welcome to Radio Free Kansas. We're having a few program changes. There's all kinds of news coming in my email box about not only G20 protesters being rounded up last weekend on the use of special acoustic weapons. They're mainly used in Iraq and Afghanistan to break up demonstrations. They're now being used in the streets of Pittsburgh. They were used in the streets of Pittsburgh. Very interesting article by Bill Quigley on Counterpunch. I'll read later tonight. Also, we're going to have the latest, evidently, the guy who produces this show, right? You regular listeners will be familiar with the Mike Cannon Radical History this week in Radical History. His, evidently, a home, some of his housemates that were raided just yesterday. Their doors were broken in, computers, cell phones seized, as well as books. Just basically left-wing paraphernalia. I haven't heard of any weapons or anything. It was just basically just the American version of the Gestapo, just kicking in doors and taking people's stuff. It's an amazing story. We'll cover that later. We might get a call, but in solidarity with Ken, I'm going to play his latest Radical History. It runs about 20 minutes. I'll be right back with you. I'll read some news.
This week's show is dedicated to all the Pittsburgh G20 protesters.
Okay, do not turn your TV volume up, please. But also, please do not be alarmed by the sound in this little bit of tape that we're about to play. This is a sound cannon being deployed against protesters at the G20 economic meeting by Pittsburgh police. That bowel liquefying annoyance is a sound cannon, or in military speak, an LRAD, a long range acoustic device, being used at not at all that long a range against Americans protesting at the G20 summit. Sound cannons can emit noise as loud as 151 decibels, the equivalent of an unsilenced gunshot being fired 3 feet from your ear. 151 decibels. For perspective, they say you can get permanent hearing loss from 110 decibels of sound, even if it's just in short bursts, not a constant sound barrage like you get from the LRAD. Adding to the cartoon villain effect, Pittsburgh police mounted the sound cannons on these menacing matte black trucks, complete with balaclava-clad ninja dudes dressed all in black, aiming the thing in the back. According to city officials, this was the first time the sound cannon had been used for crowd control in Pittsburgh. The police also used tear gas and stun grenades that explode with sharp flashes of light and beanbag projectiles shot out of guns, and of course the good old-fashioned nightstick.
We're gonna rise up and take what's there. But finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This week in Radical History for the week starting September 28th.
What we got to say, fight the power.
Inspiration came from Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Fight the power.
There is something going on in the east side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in Radical History for September 28th, 1893, Emma Goldman goes on trial in New York City, sent back to the Tombs until the 18th of October, the day sent for sentence, with the judge given a new rent-free home for a year in Blackwater Island Penitentiary. Her crime: given a speech. Also on September 28, 1901, in the Philippines, guerrillas ambush U.S. troops, killing 48 U.S. soldiers. General Jack Smith orders his troops to kill everyone on the island. Following his butchery, Hell-Roaring Jake was promoted to Brigadier General and put in charge of the Samar campaign to pacify our little brown brothers. In Samar, Smith earned fame with his orders to kill everyone over the age of 10 and make the island in a howling wilderness. In May of 1902, Smith was court-martialed and was forced retired with no other punishment. the travesty of our involvement in the Philippines when we had designs to turn it into our westernmost state, and many of these turn-of-the-century atrocities go largely forgotten in this country's history. Also on September 28, 1917, 166 Wobblies, Industrial Workers of the World, IWW Union activists, indicted for interfering with the war effort, you know, the war to end all wars, the first move on an illegal but successful U.S. government campaign to cripple the radical union movement. A year later in Canada, the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW Union, is outlawed. Also on this date in 1919, a mob forms outside Omaha, Nebraska courthouse. The courthouse set afire and Mayor Ed P. Smith is hung. They seize William Brown, a black man, accused of raping a white woman. He was tossed in jail, though he is crippled. The mob gets him, hangs him, shoots him, and then drags his body through the town. After committing these acts of murder, the mob goes on a rampage throughout downtown Omaha, breaking windows and stealing goods from storefronts. Troops are finally called in on the 30th to put an end to the chaos. It is considered one of the most notorious lynchings in U.S. history, involving tens of thousands of good Christian people. Two more items for September 28, 1973. ITT headquarters in New York is bombed by the Weather Underground in response to U.S.-backed coup in Chile. Lastly, in 1990, President Reagan says, quote, "We have never interfered with the internal government of any country," unquote. This guy was not only elected president, America loves to regale his fairy tales. Yeah, we've never interfered with the internal affairs of any country. Never. Never happened. Pay no attention to the man. This week in Radical History for September 29, 1879. Earlier today, U.S. troops attack a peaceful Ute Indian party while they're working along the Mill River at the reservation run in Colorado's White River Agency. The agency head, Mr. Meeker, frustrated that the Utes would not bow to his wishes to change the form from hunting to farming, so he calls in the army. Before the fighting ends today, 37 Utes die in a desperate stand to save the reservation from military seizure. The Utes' crime, hunting and fishing along the river's edge. Also on September 29, 1906, U.S. sends in the army to Cuba to protect American interests, like protecting the mob-run casinos and sex tourism for wealthy Americans. Also on this date in 1921 in Russia, the Cheka Bolshevik secret police execute Vanya Boron and nine other anarchist prisoners. Trotsky, who ordered the execution, remarks at the time, "We do not imprison the real anarchists, but criminals and bandits who cover themselves by claiming to be anarchists." Emma Goldman would write about the execution of Fanon Brannon. Fanon was a type of Russian woman completely concentrated in the cause of humanity. I find it funny at the same time in America, the Palmer raids continue to round up anarchists and other radicals, imprison and or deport them. Interesting that two supposedly completely different political systems, communism and capitalism democracy, works towards wiping out anarchists. Why, you might ask? Because the anti-authoritarian philosophy of anarchists is a potent threat to these top-down, chauvinistic, unequal organizing of society. Also on this date in 1936, 11 members of the Detroit Black Legion, a security arm of the Michigan KKK, convicted of the murder of Charles Poley, a WPA organizer. The KKK Black Legion is organized along military lines. The Michigan Legion had 5 brigades, 16 regiments, 64 battalions, 256 companies, and probably numbered between 20,000 and 30,000 members, one-third of whom lived in Detroit. The Legion saw as its enemies not only blacks, Jews, and Catholics, but also welfare workers and recipients and labor union organizing. It is true that racism rears its ugly head in the southern states. However, Jim Crow laws and anti-black attitudes abound in northern states as well, still to this day. Here's a short segment from Black Agenda Radio.
A recent Associated Press Yahoo survey of racial attitudes found disturbingly high levels of anti-black prejudice among whites of both major political parties and among white independents. One-third of white Democrats displayed negative feelings towards African Americans, as did 40% of all white Americans. Observers of black politics have long known that white polling data is unreliable in elections pitting white candidates against blacks. Consistently, over the space of decades, significant portions of the white electorate have been shown to overstate their willingness to vote for an African American. That is, they lie. Of course, projecting white behavior in the absence of prejudice is the ultimate fantasy, given the foundational role racism has played in American life. But in real life, such voters simply find some other reason to vote against the black candidate, and are therefore never forced to confront their racism. And those reasons are potentially infinite. Between 20 and 30% of whites of all parties associate blacks with the words violent, boastful, and complaining. This is certainly nothing new to Barack Obama, since he's hired the best in-house pollsters that Goldman Sachs money can buy, which may explain why he denounces blacks who complain and paints young black men with the broad brush of irresponsibility, the better to convince whites that he understands or even shares their racial attitudes. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
That was an edited version of Black Agenda Radio.
This is your agent to support us with your tax pay. On this day, September 29th, in 1970, the National Chicano Moratorium was still inspiring many smaller public demonstrations. 1 month earlier, the moratorium carried 30,000 Chicanos across the U.S. to Los Angeles streets in protest of the Vietnam War. These marchers recognized the disproportionate number of dead Chicano soldiers in Vietnam and the government's systematic recruitment of poor people and people of color to fight in the war. When they finally reached Laguna Park in East L.A., waiting for them were hundreds of armed LAPD who began harassing and attacking their peaceful protests. The protesters fought back. Police answered with tear gas and batons, and three Chicano marchers died. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
Two more items for this week in Radical History for September 29th, 1982. U.S. Marines land in Lebanon to protect American interests. Also on September 29th, 1988, Veterans Peace Convoy wins lawsuit banning executive branch from regulating or prohibiting aid to a foreign country intending to relieve suffering. Though harassed continuously, peace convoys of all kinds make regular runs to Cuba and other humanitarian efforts throughout the world. This week in Radical History for September 30th, I only have two items. Showing how much of a democratic law-abiding nation Israel is, like in 1986 when Vanunu is kidnapped by Israeli secret police in Rome and taken back to Israel. Vanunu, who leaked details of Israel's secret nuclear weapons program to the London Times, was convicted in a secret Israeli military court and held in solitary confinement in Israel prisons for the next 10 years. Also on that date in 1991, CIA-financed military coup in Haiti overthrows the democratically elected government of Aristide. 3 years of protecting U.S. interests follow state-sponsored murder, rape, and theft. Why do we evade so much, you might ask? As poet and owner of the City Lights books once said, our government is a bird of two right wings. They are devoted to perpetuation and spread of corporate capitalism. This week in Radical History for October 1st, 1838, the Trail of Tears. 4,000 Cherokees die when 17,000 of them are forced west by U.S. President Jackson's Indian Removal Act. Also on October 1st, 1851, William Henry, a runaway slave and craftsman from Syracuse, New York, is arrested by U.S. Marshals and scheduled to be returned to slavery. 10,000 citizens of the city storm the sheriff's office, free Henry, and aid his escape to Canada via the Underground Railroad. Also on October 1st, 1860, San Francisco land speculator and self-entitled Norton I, Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico, bars Congress from meeting in Washington. Congress meets anyways. Also on this date in 1867, anarchist Fernand Pelletier is born in Paris. Encouraged anarchist participation in trade unions, which was actually revolutionary then, favoring direct action, sabotage, and general strikes, and the rejection of political parties. Quote, we are men without gods, without masters and fatherland, irreconcilable enemies of any despotism, moral or collective laws, dictatorships, and impassioned lovers of the culture of oneself. Lastly, in a state in 1949, Pacific Foundation starts the first radio station, KPFA, in Berkeley, California. Kudos to Pacific Foundation for all their efforts. And happy anniversary. This week in Radical History for October 2nd, I only got a couple items. In 1947, radical Native American author and activist Ward Churchill is born. Here's a little bit of Churchill speaking.
I'm going to get serious about this and be anti-war. That's kind of like being anti-sky. Is there any particular war or form of war or more substantive content you might be against? My being against it doesn't affect it at all. I'm going to have to actually do something about it. And we need to be talking about what it is we're going to do and how we can do it better than it was done the last time, because I'm old enough to remember the late 60s and the anti-war movement, which is a major chunk of society at the time. And we're right here confronting the reality that we have to do it again, which means we didn't do it right then. Okay? So spare me all the rehashed Dave Dillinger rhetoric from the 1960s, because guess what? That didn't stop the Vietnam War. The Vietnamese stopped the Vietnam War. They won it, and they didn't win it with prayer vigils and mass marches.
Also on October 2nd, 1986, Reagan, who's sure there must be some commie involvement in the anti-apartheid movement, in a rare act of Congress doing the right thing, overrides Reagan's veto and passes the South African sanctions. This week in Radical History for October 3rd.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 3rd in 1909, white American feminist, anarchist, and free love advocate Lois Weisbrucker died at the age of 84. Lois belonged to a small group of women known as the Free Lovers who pursued sexual autonomy and actively challenged society's ideas of sexual respectability. The Free Lovers sought to liberate women from the belief that sex was an all-male terrain. They encouraged women to acknowledge their own sexual desires, to pursue their right to enjoy sex, and not to be ashamed of their own bodies. In their quest to redefine women's sexuality, the Free Lovers stressed the importance of the woman's right to say no, as well as yes. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on October 3rd, 1932, all 164 students in the Kincaid High School in Illinois walk out on strike after they discover that the school is being heated with coal from a company employing scab labor. Also on October 3rd, folk singer Woody Guthrie dies on this date in New York City at the age of 52 in 1967. He helped transform the folk ballad into a vehicle of social protest and observation. He paved the way for Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, and a host of other folk and rock songwriters who have been moved by the conscience to share experiences and voice opinions in a forthright manner. Here's just one of those singers.
At 11 in the morning, we all heard the factory blow. The blast took out the windows and the shrapnel fell like snow. We could get no help from out of town for half a day or more. We had near 1,000 casualties and beds for 94. And can you keep your head, your backbone, or your heart? We all found out the answer on the day it fell apart. It was worse than combat medicine, supplies were draining fast. Bandages ran out and antiseptics wouldn't last. I took all the able-bodied I could catch inside the door and made them help the doctors or go scrounge supplies and more. I invented laws to tell them, saying in such emergency, forget your usual job and boss, your orders come from me. I sent the cops to commandeer anything in reach, food or disinfectant, cloth or alcohol or bleach. And can you keep your head, your backbone or your heart? We all found out the answer on the day it fell apart. The janitor ran cleanup squad, the cook maintained supplies. The garbage man removed the ones who died before our eyes. The clerks burned all our papers to boil water on the fire for sterilizing instruments as the body count went higher. A local health food herbalist brought everything he had. The painkillers were useful and the poultices weren't bad. A smacking cocaine pusher handed us his whole supply. The quality was lousy, but a few more didn't die. And can you keep your head, your backbone, or your heart? We all found out the answer on the day it fell apart. We did triage in the parking lot, ranked minor, major, grave. A sad-eyed fireman gave the stroke to those we couldn't save. Then sometime in the chaos, a director wandered in to tell us we were breaking rules, what trouble we'd be in. But if we swear the factory was not the fire's cause, and the harm was accidental, he'd forget the broken laws. The staff sneaked up and grabbed him and tied him to a door. He gave them blood transfusions till he hadn't any more. Your backbone or your heart? We all found out the answer on the day it fell apart. When that day was over and we'd saved all that we could, we saw that law and politics would hang us where we stood. We'd saved 800 lives but shattered all authority. I told them, people, save yourselves, put all the blame on me. I took my books and instruments and a few supplies beside, packed my car and ran away to open countryside. So now I live an outlaw, condemned by righteous men. But for all the lives I saved that day, I'd do it all again. And can you keep your head, your backbone, or your heart? We all found out the answer on the day it fell apart. Can you keep your head, your backbone, or your heart? You'll all find out the answers on the day it falls apart.
Couple more days with only a couple more items each to finish up this week's show, This Week in Radical History for October 4th. In an attempt to get his mafia friends back to the casinos in Cuba, on this date in 1962, President JFK calls for more CIA covert sabotage against Cuba, known as Operation Mongoose. Also on that date in 1974, ex-CIA agent Philip Agee publishes the names of 37 CIA spies in an effort to undermine the CIA terrorism policies and murdering, kidnapping, torture, assassination, and other crimes against humanity. The U.S. would try to get him extradited back to the United States for years, and would eventually pass a law seeming to aim right at people like Agee. The Intelligent Identities Protection Act was passed, and then directly violated, of course, during the Valerie Plame, Dick Cheney year, and Justice for All. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. I'd like to thank the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York for the audio I borrowed for this show. Also thanks to the Slingshot Organizer and the Daily Bleed website for both information and inspiration for this show. I'll conclude this week's show with a short segment I produced called Bush versus the Anarchist Revolution. Until next week's This Week in Radical History, as always and forever, I'm yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
From where Winston stood, it was possible to read, picked out on his white face in elegant lettering, the three slogans of the party: war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
I remember how the meaning of words began to change. How unfamiliar words like collateral and rendition became frightening. While things like Northfire and the Articles of Allegiance became powerful. I remember how different became dangerous. I still don't understand it. Why they hate us so much.
I want this country to realize that we stand on the edge of oblivion. I want every man, woman, and child to understand how close we are to chaos. I want everyone to remember why they need us.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. Oh, revolution without dancing is a revolution not worth having.
A reminder of what another anarchist and feminist, Emma Goldman, once said: if voting never really changed anything, they would have made it illegal.
And I'm not ashamed about getting drunk, and I don't care what you say, cause I believe in anarchy. Thank you.
goes, yes. The sound and the fury. Yes, this is no teabagging outfit. No Glenn Beck here, the new white Jesus. Breaking the doors down, taking the people's computers. Oh, yes, the clamp down. Yes, folks, and, you know, when you're a teabagger, you go out to like 9-12 is organized by the Fox News media, and Glenn Beck in particular, the new white Jesus for mainstream America, all those disgruntled middle-class pissants, who he calls sick, twisted freaks, are out there, and they go to the Washington Mall, and no one really knows how many are there. Hundreds of thousands, millions, who knows, show up there, and not one little problem. But you get into a little bit of stuff, and you never know, you know. You get a little bit of stuff at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, there's all kinds of news coming in. Here's some little bit of excerpt of one, and then I'll play. I want to read some.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
So this is Rabble Rouser in Pittsburgh for the G20 summit. Some experiences we experienced en route. Number one, the most engaging aspect was a series of phone calls that my home number received, threatening my wife and threatening my safety, with a phone number leading back to Department of Homeland Security. The voice was using some kind of a voice modifying system. I'm not going to say too much. This is stuff that I guess happens. I didn't expect it to happen to me, but nobody ever does. Further on the route, we saw about 20 Halliburton trucks in line going in a convoy with a lot of machinery attached to the trucks, bright red trucks with Halliburton logo on the side. And then we get to town, and there's a Chinook helicopters and Apache helicopters flying overhead pretty much nonstop. A very present military, and the everybody who doesn't understand this or know this or heard this, the National Guard troop or infantry that's here flew in last night fresh from Iraq. So they're sending in soldiers with no downtime between being in a war zone, being in Pittsburgh. Today, walking the perimeters of Arsenal Park, where a lot of more radical actions are planned, we saw many many strange vehicles, such as a very large truck that said relocation services on the site. This is a semi-trailer truck right beside the park, and the park is literally surrounded with media and military. There's military on the rooftops. Arsenal Park's history is it was in the 1800s a military base. Probably even further back than that, considering the military history of Pittsburgh. But there's barracks already in place that have been in place, historic buildings. And today we saw a multitude of fully decked out military troops going in and out of the barracks there where the protest is planned. And there's a stalled train that's been sort of hanging out on the train tracks a mere 3 blocks away. Today, news reports in Pittsburgh, they released over 100 convicted criminals from the county jails based on catching on a hierarchy of their crimes, just released them ahead of time to clear space for protesters. And the business owner by the park who I took the time to speak with to see what his knowledge was said that they warned the businesses of what was going to happen and said that there's not too much to fear because they've got the park contained and they're going to be taking every one of them to jail.
Really?
So now we're just we're perusing the 3 or 4 miles.
Yes, that's Rabble Rouser. He runs a regular show over on Blog Talk Radio, Rabble Rouser Radio. It's part of the Bottom Up Radio Network, of which I'm a member. And also, again, Mike Cannon's housemates were raided just yesterday. Rabble Rouser's telephone was messed with when he took off to go to Pittsburgh for the protests. Really weird, stupid kind of stuff. I mean, it's pretty wild when you just hit call *67, it dials back to the Department of Homeland Security just moments after receiving a phone call, and a voice disguised ran through some sort of computer saying you're gonna the guy's gonna get up when he shows up there, threatening with physical assault, and this real weird voice, and then the person at the house who received the call, *67, it went, rang back to the Department of Homeland Security, a public number. Do you believe how stupid and brazen and horrible that these people are being? The police state is quite active. This is insane stuff, I'm telling you. Cannon's house was crashed into. They take his computer, his cell phone. They even took black and white flag that his mother made him. It's sadly also particularly painful is that he said he Mike Cannon says he's into about $5,000 right now. He's going to have to raise some money. We're trying to put a word out to everybody about this. We need to make some donations. We haven't got a fund set up yet that I know of. Later in the show, we may have some news coming from the ambassador. I was telling you earlier, contesting G20 protests with the 9/12 teabagger march and organized by the new white Jesus, Glenn Beck, and the Rupert Murdoch machine, Fox News. You know, if you go out and run around and sing the anthems and God Bless America wave flags and call and engage in all kinds of red baiting where you smear Obama, they think it's a smear. I think we're in the middle of a new Red Scare. I think this is the beginning. And I think it's ironic that it's being organized under the auspices of the Obama administration. I think that's made stuff. A very interesting. It's almost like the infrastructure is rebelling against Obama. The white middle class, angry white people, angry cops, rebelling against the Obama administration, and what they perceive it represents in terms of red politics. It's a very interesting situation we're living in. Now, this is Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg put out a weekly program called Building Bridges. This is dedicated to the G20, not necessarily the protest, but to the actual rooms. It runs about 28 minutes. I'll be back with you.
Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Social Watch fights to put people's needs before capital at the G20.
We focus on the G20 and the summit at the United Nations. The G20 countries are the architects of the global economic crisis, many of them.
In protest is Social Watch, who will be unveiling their 2009 report, People First. Social Watch is also in the United States to lobby the attendees of the UN General Assembly meeting to respond to the economic crisis of developing and the poorest countries.
Now, Social Watch fights to put people's needs before capital at the G20 with Janice Silverman, coordinator of campaigns of Social Watch, an NGO network monitoring poverty eradication and gender equality. Roberto Bisio, coordinator of Social Watch and executive director of the Third World Institute located in Uruguay, and Amitabh Behar, co-coordinator of Social Watch in India. And it's a pleasure to have all of you with us.
Thanks to you, Mimi.
And you can't see this, Jana and Amitabh, but I'm sitting here and Ken and I are feeling the heat from the hot off the press, wonderful, really gorgeous looking Social Watch Report 2009 that Roberto was kind enough to bring up to us. So we're going to start in earnest by getting, we're going to unembargo it and get some of the insights from this very important report, People First. And thank you for bringing us our copies, Roberto.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's really a people's report. It includes the conclusion from civil society organizations in 61 countries, and they are reporting on how the global crisis is affecting them.
Jana, I just want to begin with yourself. You're in Pittsburgh now, and just give us a sense of the importance of this gathering.
Well, basically, we're here to share views that are reflecting what's being expressed in our 2009 report, which is basically saying that the best way out of the crisis, not just in terms of to fulfill the criteria of social justice, but also as a sort of good business practice or good economic practice, is actually to invest in people. As we well know, as listeners in New York well know, that the bailouts last year have only benefited the bankers on Wall Street, while, you know, the people are, well, maybe a few of the bankers from Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns have had to sell their multi-million-dollar apartments. There's more than 3 million people who've lost their mortgages. And if we look at the cases in developing countries, the situation is even more stark because the issues of workers who are migrant workers who are beginning to return to their countries who cannot send back the remittances that used to send back, and that are now actually meaning that people now have less access to education, jobs, health care, the basic necessities of life. And so if recovery packages don't deal with these kind of issues as well, there's no way that we'll be able to find a just solution to the crisis.
Amitabh, if you could build on what Jana was talking about, but be more specific as to the experience of India and the crisis.
I would just build on that and say that, in fact, it's been 1 year now, and all the bailout packages have, in fact, further excluded the poor and the marginalized. With the financial crisis and was also a hope that there would be some restructuring in terms of the financial relationships, in terms of the economic order. But all that we have seen over the past 1 year are policies which have, in fact, led only to poor becoming poorer. And there is existing food crisis. In a country like India, we have, even according to our own government estimates, 30% people living without 3 square meals a day. From our report, we can also tell you from the Social Watch report that almost 50% of the income is spent by the poor on food. So what we're looking at is a worsening of poverty and marginalization in the wake of the global financial crisis. Though we are also hoping that, given that this could have been an opportunity to restructure this free market neoliberal capitalist framework, that's really not happened.
The world has changed a lot in the last decade, previous precisely to the crisis, because there used to be that the South was indebted. We were talking about debt, and it was always referred to Southern countries being indebted because of some irresponsibility of their leaders in how they spent their money. What is happening now is that the so-called G7 countries, the richest countries of the world, are all of them highly indebted countries at this moment. They have been spending beyond their means. They are highly indebted. And the creditor countries are some of the poorest countries of the world. China, India, Brazil are now creditors of the United States. Now, this is a very odd situation. This is not how things should have been. The idea around the liberalization of financial exchanges, the creation of a single global market for finances, was that the market brings in the demand and the offer. So where the money was abundant was the offer, and where the money was needed was in the poorest countries. Therefore, the money should have gone in form of investment, in form of capital transfer from the rich countries to the poor countries. What happened in practice was the other way around, that the money is flowing from the poorest countries of the world to the rich countries, from some of them. And that is nonsense, really. And that kind of liberalization is behind what created the crisis. So much money coming into the United States, lent by China, lent by Brazil, lent by India even, although India not so much. Where was that money going to? Everybody talks about the subprime, the mortgage crisis, how people were given loans when they couldn't pay back. But the problem was that all that money coming in had to go somewhere. And therefore, the people were almost forcing people to contract mortgages, to borrow money that perhaps they didn't need or that they couldn't pay back. That's one of the aspects of the crisis. That's one of the aspects of the whole malfunctioning of the global finances. So we were expecting a re-regulation, a reorientation. We were expecting, after realization of how it all collapsed, and how it all collapsed and the losses were socialized. All around the world, the taxpayers are paying for to keep bankrupt banks alive. Now, that nonsense has not been brought to an end, and the restructuring of international finances has not yet happened, and the agenda of Pittsburgh, in a way, those issues are in there. Some countries have debated that the kind of bonuses that the banks pay to their employees are really nonsense, because they don't motivate people to invest wisely. They just motivate them to get short-term earnings. And so, therefore, that practice should be abandoned. That is a proposal that France and Germany have made. But this is resisted by others. As we know, some people don't want major changes in the whole global finances. Other countries, the new creditors like Brazil and China, they are worried that their assets nominated in dollars might lose their value if the dollar devalues in relation with other currencies. The dollar is right now at its lowest value ever in relation with the euro, for example. as any American wanting to travel to Europe would notice, you know, that you can buy very little with dollars right now. That is a problem for the countries that have invested their savings in dollars, because they are seeing their savings deteriorating in that sense. And so they are wondering whether some other forms of having international reserves should be established, should be go back to the gold standard that was prevailing until basically Nixon in 71 got rid of it, or shall we create a kind of new international currency, as has been proposed, among others, by Joseph Stiglitz, economist and Nobel Prize winner, that made that suggestion to the General Assembly of the United Nations. So those are issues that, in a sense, if we talked about them a year ago or 2 years ago, we would be called, are you crazy? But now they are really in the agenda of the heads of states.
Now, one of the things, again, I'm just looking at this, and it's appropriately, maybe, in red, the report from Social Watch People First, and just some of the statistics that are printed in a summary on the back cover. Peru, for example, 200,000 layoffs, as well as a fall in the purchasing power of wages and savings. In the Benin, the price of maize, the most widely consumed product, soared 220%. Sub-Saharan Africa, women continue to be the first to lose their jobs and are increasingly finding themselves engaged in petty informal trading of vegetables and tomatoes as a coping mechanism. And we could go on and on and on. India, there's been drastically reduced growth in personal and consumer loans and industrial production. Amitabh, I just want to, within the context of this, aside from painting a picture of what this economic crisis has meant, I wondered if you have thoughts on this, because the last time members of Social Watch were here, one of the things we listened to was President Rafael Correa of Ecuador talk about the elimination, if you will, of the International Monetary Fund as very much a part of the problem. I was hoping you might give us some of your thoughts on both the impact as well as looking at these financial mechanisms of capital and what they really have done in the world community. Amitabh?
I would, in fact, largely agree with the thought of doing away with IMF and the World Bank, the way they function, which are totally undemocratic, where you have seven countries controlling the entire financial architecture of the globe with vetoes for the U.S. and the European Union. And these policies, the policies that these financial institutions pursue, have only caused havoc and devastation in the poor countries of the South. So there is an urgent need to totally restructure these bodies and start looking at more democratic, participatory institutions. And I would say that, in fact, it would be very, very critical that we don't end up only ensuring participation of governments, but we need to also look at participation of citizens and civil society groups if we really want to do a turnaround from the perspective of the poor. Because given the condition, the way the policies are pursued, it's usually the rich who benefit. Even in a country like India, where we've been looking at a 9 to 10% growth rate over the past 6-7 years, after the financial crisis, it's come down to 6%, but again, the worst affected are the poor, marginal farmers, are the women, and it's also people in the informal sector. So there's an urgent need to totally restructure the financial institutions, global financial institutions.
Jano, in terms of all of these organizations, the IMF, the World Bank, the G20, one of the organizations that we don't hear that much about, and we heard it from you when you were with us in June, was the United Nations as a force in this conversation. You were here in June talking about the UN conference on the world financial and economic crisis, and I know that's why Roberto is in the U.S. in New York now. So why don't you tell us a bit about what happened in June and how that lays the basis for the United Nations to get involved, which of course represents a much wider number of countries than the G20.
Right. Well, the June conference in New York at the United Nations was a historic opportunity. It was the first time that all of the world's countries, the so-called G192, which is the number of countries in the United Nations General Assembly, were able to voice their opinions about what they believe was the way out of the crisis, taking into consideration not just the needs of the rich countries or the so-called emerging countries such as India and China, but the countries, the least developed countries, small island nations that have always been the forgotten countries on the world scenario. And the outcome document of the UN conference was interesting, although maybe some of the proposals weren't quite as radical as some civil society activists had wanted. It did reaffirm the fact that the rich countries were responsible for the crisis and therefore must take into account poor countries who are suffering the impacts without having been responsible for its creation. It also talks about giving more policy space for developing countries who are being hit hard by the protectionist measures of rich countries, which are using that as one of their responses to the crisis. And it also emphasizes the need for a more systemic reform of the international financial institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank. And this is extremely important when we consider that when we look at what the G20 and the G8 has proposed, is basically throwing a lot more money at the IMF and World Bank, $1.1 trillion to be exact, but without demanding any kind of substantial reforms in return. So and from the UN, there's a recognition that the global financial architecture needs to be fundamentally changed in order to prevent these crises from occurring again.
One of the things that, again, just looking at some statistics that have been floated, in this case by the UN, they speak about 222 million workers running the risk of joining the ranks of the working poor, which for them means earning less than $1.25 a day. And another issue that we haven't mentioned, which is creating tremendous hardships, is the remittance flows, which reached $328 billion in 2008, and they're about to drop 7.3% in 2009. Another issue that was raised was that hunger rates are up in every region in the world, so that there is the crisis is of astronomical proportion. And I should say in our own country that there's a rejuvenation, if you will, of the economy, but without the workers coming along with it, without jobs. So how do your recommendations and how do the considerations of Social Watch, et cetera, Roberto, address what is to be done fundamentally on this dire crisis and with such a multiplicity of problems?
The problems are indeed enormous. It is always been said that crisis also means opportunity. Now, the opportunity with this crisis is, on the one hand, the opportunity to really reform international finances. Now, 40 countries are about to be unable to pay their obligations because the commodities they export have dropped so dramatically, they don't have the income and so on. So there is going to be, we are on the eve of a major debt crisis. Now that means you have to have mechanisms of moratorium at least for a while. Like when the tsunami came in, the countries affected were allowed not to pay their debts until they could recover from the catastrophe. Well, the crisis is a catastrophe of a similar thing, so you have to give those countries a space. And you also have to create a tribunal, like in the case of bankruptcies, that decides how much of that debt really ought to be paid. Now, there is the opportunity to establish precisely that. Who is going to tell those countries, among them some of the poorest in the world, that they have to pay anyhow, even when their people are suffering hunger, when really big corporations are not allowed to go bankrupt and they are being rescued? So why, during many years, we have said that what we need in order to eradicate poverty from the world is $100 billion a year of aid. And we've been told that's inconceivable, there isn't that money, so how can you demand that kind of things and so on. Now, when big corporations were facing problems, not just hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars appeared to rescue them. Where was that money? Well, so how could that be created? And the problem of really getting rid of extreme poverty around the world. What we are talking about is not providing a car for each family. It's providing three meals a day for each child. That's the point. And that can be done. We have the resources, we have the knowledge, we have the expertise to do that. What is missing is the political will. Now, that should be in the agenda. And countries that have started to do that kind of thing, what they have found out is that by doing that, you really recover the economy. By providing poor women in Brazil with an income of $60 a month, you activate local economies to an enormous proportion. So that is the best rescue package, is really to invest in people, to create the jobs, to provide people with an opportunity. That will reactivate the economy much more than socializing the losses of big banks and big corporations.
Amitad, what else needs to be done, or perhaps what needs to be undone?
I think Roberto has already said it. And as he said, I was reading somewhere that in the last 1 year, the money which has come in for the bailout has been 50 times the amount which was done for ODA. So there's a clear lack of political will. And in terms of the solution, I think what Roberto is saying is very central to the solution, that we need to start looking at a recovery package which is based on keeping people first, where people are at the center. So you are trying to build an economy from the bottom and not by bailing out bankrupt banks and highly paid executives. And I think it's very, very crucial for an audience here to appreciate that we are not talking about, as Roberto said, poverty, about getting cars, but in a country like India, it's about survival, it's about dignity, it's about getting education, it's about getting basic vaccinations, so infant mortality rate, it is about basic food. So there has to be a complete turnaround of the way we look at our economies and where we keep the poor and the marginalized at the center, and then build the economy upward. So let's also hope that we can probably see this as an opportunity. But at this moment, the signs coming from G20 are quite contrary to that. And I think there is a need for a strong civil society protest and urging its own governments and the G20 to change course.
And Jen, I just want to know, what do you think needs to be done in terms of increasing the clout of the developing nations and the poorest countries? And we have about a minute and a half left, and of course we want to tell people where they can get copies of this remarkable and important report. Jenna?
Well, I think what needs to be done, not just in developing countries but also in developed countries, is change the balance of power between workers and capital, which is the workers' movement and the women's movement and the movement of the poorest people in developing countries as well, has been on the defensive since the 1970s. And I think this is our opportunity to start taking, reclaiming that power, because without protest, without struggle, there is no rights, as has been said. And so I think this is the best way. And I'm just using a very quick example. In where I and Roberto live, in Uruguay, this is a country where about 4 years ago, a left-wing government supported by the trade unions came into power. And since that time, because of the shifting sort of the terms of debate, workers, collective bargaining has gone up, workers' salaries have gone up, minimum wage has gone up, the social security benefits have gone up, and Uruguay isn't suffering the same impacts of the crisis that we see in the United States or that we see in other countries in Africa or Asia. And so I think this is the key. We need to, through struggle, we can take back what the bosses have been stealing from us over the last 30 years, and that's the only way that we can find a just solution to the crisis for those who are suffering, its impacts.
And if you want to put some theoretical meat on the bones that Roberto and Amitabh and Jana have been discussing with us, you can go to www.socialwatch.org. Hey, that's easy, socialwatch.org, and you can download the full version of the report or order printed copies from a Social Watch, and the report is People First, and that's exactly where it's at. And a special thanks to Roberto Bifio, coordinator of Social Watch and executive director of the Third World Institute in Uruguay, and Amitabh Biha, co-coordinator of Social Watch in India, and Jana Silverman, coordinator of campaigns of Social Watch and NGO network monitoring poverty eradication and gender equality. We'll have you on lots more, because each time we do, we get some real constructive ideas around which to organize. Thank you for being with us.
No, thanks to you.
And the Eddie Star, hey, still talking about revolution, the revolution, jobs at living wages, still the issue, as well as redistributing the wealth to those who created it. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
This is a street report from the G20 as published in Counterpunch on September 29th by Bill Quigley, who is an attorney, a civil rights attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's called The Militarization of Pittsburgh. I'm your host at Radio Free Kansas, Mike Cadell. I'll try reading this to you. I have some news following that. The G20 in Pittsburgh showed us how pitifully fearful our leaders have become. What no terrorist could do to us, our own leaders did. Out of fear of the possibility of a terrorist attack, authorities militarize our towns, scare our people away, stop daily life, and quash our constitutional rights. For days, downtown Pittsburgh, home to the G20, was turned into a militarized, people-free ghost town. Sirens screamed day and night. Helicopters crisscrossed the skies. Gunboats set in the rivers. The skies were defended by Air Force jets. Streets were barricaded by huge cement blocks and fencing. Bridges were closed with National Guard across the entrances. Public transportation was stopped downtown. Amtrak train service was suspended for days. In many areas, there were armed police every 100 feet. Businesses closed. Schools closed. Tens of thousands were unable to work. 4,000 police were on duty, plus 2,100 National Guard, plus Coast Guard and Air Force, and dozens of other security agencies. 1,000 volunteers from other police forces were sworn in to help out. Police were dressed in battle gear, bulky black Ninja Turtle outfits, helmets with clear visors, strapped-on body armor, shin guards, big boots, batons, and long guns. In addition to helicopters, the police had hundreds of cars and motorcycles, heard vehicles, monster trucks, and small electric go-karts. There were even passenger vans screaming through the town, so stuffed with heavily armed Ninja Turtles that the side and rear doors remained open. No terrorists showed up at the G20. Since no terrorists showed up, those in charge of the heavily armed security forces chose to deploy their forces around those who were protesting. Not everyone is delighted that 20 countries control 80% of the world's resources. Several thousand of them chose to express their displeasure by protesting. Unfortunately, the officials in charge thought it was more important to create a militarized, people-free zone around the G20 people than to allow freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, or the freedom to protest. It took a lawsuit by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, to get any major protest permitted anywhere near downtown Pittsburgh. Even then, the police, quote, forgot what was permitted and turned people away from areas of town. Hundreds of police also harassed a bus of people who were giving away free food, repeatedly detaining the bus and searching it and its passengers without any warrants. But then a group of young people decided that they did not need a permit to express their human and constitutional freedom. They announced they were going to hold their own gathering at a city park down the deserted city streets to protest the G20. Maybe 200 of these young people were self-described anarchists, dressed in black, many with bandanas across their faces. They warned everyone these people were very scary. My cab driver said the anarchist spokesperson looked like Harry Potter in a black hoodie. The anarchists were joined in the park by hundreds of other activists of all ages, and ultimately around 1,000 strong, all insisting on exercising their right to protest. This drove the authorities crazy. Battle-dressed Ninja Turtles showed up at the park and formed a line across one entrance. Helicopters buzzed overhead. Armored vehicles gathered. The crowd surged out of the park and up a side street, yelling, chanting, drumming, and holding signs. As they exited the park, everyone passed an ice cream truck that was playing "It's a Small World After All." Indeed. Any remaining doubts about the militarization of the police were dispelled shortly after the crowd left the park. A few blocks away, the police unveiled their latest high-tech anti-protester toy. It was mounted on the back of a huge black truck. The Pittsburgh Gazette described it as a long-range acoustic device designed to break up crowds with piercing noise. Similar devices had been used in Fallujah, Mosul, and Basra, Iraq. The police backed the truck up, told people not to go any further down the street, and then blasted them with piercing noise. The crowd then moved to other streets. Now they were being tracked by helicopters. The police repeatedly tried to block them from regrouping, ultimately tear gas into the crowd, injuring hundreds, including people in the residential neighborhood, where the police decided to confront the marchers. I was treated to some of the tear gas myself, and I found the Pittsburgh brand to be spiced with a hint of kielbasa. Fortunately, I was handed some paper towels soaked in apple cider vinegar, which helped fight the tears and cough a bit. Who would have thought? After the large group broke and ran from the tear gas, smaller groups went into the commercial neighborhoods and broke glass at a bank and a couple of other businesses. The police chased and the glass breakers ran, and the police chased and the people ran for a few hours. By day, the police were menacing, but at night, they lost their cool. Around a park by the University of Pittsburgh, the Ninja Turtles pushed and shoved and beat and arrested, not just protesters, but people passing by. One young woman reported she and her friend watched Grey's Anatomy on television and were on their way back to their dorm room when they were cornered by police. One was bruised by a police baton, and her friend was arrested. Police shot tear gas, pepper spray, smoke canisters, and rubber bullets. They pushed with big plastic shields and struck with batons. The biggest march was on Friday. Thousands of people from Pittsburgh and other places protested the G20. Since the court had ruled on this march, the police did not confront the marchers. Ninja Turtle police showed up in formation sometimes, and the helicopters hovered. Confrontations occurred. Again, Friday night, riot-clad police fought with students outside of the University of Pittsburgh. It was just as unclear as the night before. Ultimately, about 200 were arrested, mostly in clashes with the police around the university. The G20 was left by helicopter and limousine. Pittsburgh now belongs again to the people of Pittsburgh. The cement barricades were removed. The fences were taken down. The bridges and roads were open. The gunboats packed away and left. The police packed away their Ninja Turtle outfits and tear gas and rubber bullets. They didn't look like military commandos anymore. No more gunboats on the river. No more sirens all the time. No more armored vehicles and ear-splitting machines used in Iraq. On Monday, the businesses will open, and kids will have to go back to school. Civil society has returned. It is now probably even safe to exercise constitutional rights in Pittsburgh once again. Yeah, the USA really showed those terrorists, didn't we? And again, Bill Quigley, a human rights lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, he can be reached at quigley77@yahoo.com. That's quigley77@yahoo.com. And thank you very much for allowing me to read that to you. So we'll go on back to play a little music while I gather my paperwork. While October 16th in Kansas City, Kansas, there'll be a commemoration to mark the 150th anniversary of John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Again, that's October 16th at the John Brown statue, located at 27th Street and Sewell Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. That's 27th Street in Sewell, that's S-E-W-E-L-L Avenue, in Kansas City, Kansas. It's sponsored by the John Brown Society. During the night of October 16th, 1859, John Brown and his men attempted to seize the federal arsenal in Harper's Ferry, aiming to arm slaves escaping from the South to freedom in the North. 2 days later, they were captured by a detachment of U.S. Marines commanded by Robert E. Lee. Brown and others of his band were charged and convicted of treason against the state of Virginia and executed the following December. Previously, Brown's group proved decisive in the armed struggle to save, quote, bleeding Kansas and ensure the defeat of slavery in that territory, paving the way for its admission to the Union in 1861. The event will last approximately 1 hour. Again, that's at the John Brown statue. On October 16th at 27th Street and Sewell Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. It'll feature speakers addressing Brown's role in Kansas, the connections of his movement to the European revolutions of 1848 and 1849, as well as readings of documents and poems honoring Brown and his small, heroic band. For more information, you can call Fred Whitehead at 913-342-6379 or by direct email to fredwh@swbell.net. And there we go. And let's see here. Here we go with interesting. Hold on here. I'll be right back with you. Of the 150th anniversary of John Brown's raid on the arsenal, the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry. Again, that's October 16th at the John Brown Statue, 27th Street and Sewell Avenue, S-S-E-W-E-L-L Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. That'll be on October 16th, a Friday. And it'll begin, what does it say here? Let me look here. The time will be 5:30 p.m. And for your information, pay attention to the flyer at the Fighting Cock. You'll hear announcements. Evidently, Fred Whitehead has consented. He'll be giving a lecture and will be showing a documentary movie at the North Jefferson County Initiative Center. That's located in Valley Falls, Kansas, and that should be sometime immediately after the October 16th event in Kansas City, Kansas. I'll be sure and get that information posted up as soon as Dr. Whitehead, gives us that. I have a couple calls online. I'm sorry you had held for so long. I'm going to open up the lines. We're talking about the media monopoly, Glenn Beck. Let's see if he's anyone's online here. Lines 1 and 2, you guys are open. You got anything to say tonight? What's on your mind tonight? Hello?
Hello?
Yes. What's on your mind tonight?
Well, I'm just tired of cleaning these damn schools up. Goddamn swine flu everywhere.
The pig flu? What are you talking about?
Well, what do they call it? The custodian flu. We got more custodians sick than you shake a stick at.
Oh, they're all getting sick?
Yep. Got that damn pig flu.
Pig flu. You got to pick up pig puke from the kids. You're going to get pig flu. You guys probably should wear moon suits right now if they're going to survive the puking and explosive diarrhea. I don't know what the symptoms I've encountered with pig flu. It's really it varies from people to people.
Well, I don't, they puke a lot.
Lots of puke.
Oh yeah, we got rivers of puke over here.
Rivers of puke. Where is this in Leavenworth County or where?
Yeah, over in Helltown.
Helltown, huh? Well, we were originally. This is supposed to be Media Monopoly roast tonight. I was planning on doing some stuff on Glenn Beck, but.
Glenn Beck, he's an asshole. He's another one that thinks swine flu is just make-believe. Well, he ought to just come out here and be a custodian and see how make-believe it is. There's no such thing as swine flu, huh? Beck, come on out here and scrub up all this puke. It's one in, it's just another one of the African American engineers. Yeah, that's what he says, that son of a bitch. Yeah, I'll take him off out here. He only kicked him off CNN because he's an idiot. Fox. Yeah, because he went to Fox News and figured he's intelligent there, you know. I don't know, morons over there. I think H1N1 is just an answer to the crossword puzzle.
That's a new one. I hadn't heard that.
I'll be out here on the front line, so you hear a lot of that. Yeah.
It's the puke bucket brigade.
Well, we just can't keep up with them.
My God.
Well, I hear hope of God. Pray to God that 20% of these damn kids get sick, so they shut the damn place down so we can go home. But that ain't going to happen.
They won't shut her down. They're going to keep
Hell no. They'll keep a city hauling his puke out. They're going to keep their school open until the last one drops. They won't close it down.
Well, it's, I fell asleep this afternoon, taking a nap, getting ready for the show tonight, and I was trying to get Glenn Beck. I'd recorded in the morning Glenn Beck. We get blasted by Glenn Beck out here from WIBW Radio 580 AM. And,
well, because it's a Republican state.
It's both sides. I mean, 7:10 AM out of Kansas City, a blowtorch, and 580 WIBW out of Topeka, a blowtorch. Just blast this. You talk about they use these loud, piercing noise machines on the G20 protesters in Pittsburgh. Well, these Republicans out here, they get blasted by Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck nonstop from both sides of the counties, on both sides of Jeff County. They're just blasted with right-wing puke propaganda.
They're going to have a captive audience when all these people at home are sick with that H1N1 back in that bad damn Rush pinball. They can sit there and listen, just yell at them all day and tell them it's all make-believe. There ain't no H1N1. It's a make-believe thing. That's why they're at home sick.
Obama's a socialist. That really gets them going. They're dragging up the old Obama's a socialist. He's red baiting. The communists have taken over the White House. It's another crazed out. I mean, they really are bombed on both sides by acoustic devices called AM radio.
Yeah, well. What's going to happen is them right wingers going to get all these people all upset and everything, and some nutpot out of the right wing is going to go and get the crackpot of Obama. And then you're going to have a revolution on your hands, and all these goddamn Democrats are going to go after the Republicans.
Oh, yeah.
You have the Democrats and all the black people going after them, those Republicans, and that'll be the end of that show.
Real dangerous lot, the Democrats.
Then you'll have to start a new radio show because you won't have anything political to talk about. What are you going to talk about then? Talk about H1N1, that's out there. We got people all over the place. We got this stuff called Sorby. You pour it on the puke so it don't stink. Hell yeah, oh. Now that shit. And that was on cat litter on it.
Bumper business and kitty litter. Absorb the puke for the kids.
Well, it's a hell of a thing. Someone's gotta do it. Yeah, my coworkers have just dropping left and right. Man, I don't know what to do.
Outbreak.
I started out with 7, now I'm down to 4. We'll see what happens. So I feel like cussing at the last stand, you know, last stand of the custodian in H1N1. I'm going to put a sign up, last custodian standing, turn off the lights when you leave.
Here's the kitty litter.
God bless you.
Well, I was telling you, I was watching the movie Outbreak with Dustin Hoffman and Morgan Freeman and...
Yeah, I've seen that movie.
Outbreak. It's a classic.
That's one of that monkey food. This is pig food.
It started with a monkey. This is pig flu.
Hey, pig flu. That's more original here in the United States. Pig flu.
What they did in Pittsburgh, you'd think they're going to do it to every country in every city and county in the world, the outbreaks. But
you know what the goddamn guy?
Helicopters, Ninja Turtle cops coming into your schools. You know, what are you going to do with that?
Give them a mop and some kitty litter. Like, look at that, reinforcements.
Just put that gun down.
Grab a mop and hit some kitty litter. How about it? Or kill something. Kill them viruses. Kill them germs.
You can wear your face mask, but you don't need all that other junk. Here's the mop. By the way, you're only getting about $10 an hour.
That 60 cents that you're making is under the help. You're getting $10 an hour to clean up too.
Yeah, welcome to the recession.
Well, I like to see them faces underneath those ninjas masks when you tell them that shit.
Turtles.
Ninja turtles. There'll be ninja custodians.
Ninja custodians. Ninja Turtle custodian.
Let's let them come on over here. I'll put them to work. I got a bunch of puke for them. What's really funny about this H1N1 virus came from pigs in Mexico. The only problem is pigs came from the United States, went to Mexico.
Then it came back.
Yeah. I said, well, we got something for you. We're going to give it back to you.
Oh, my God. Oh. Well, silent news story there. We are roasting the media monopoly because we're not getting any of that news out here on the streets to blowtorch blasting right wing crap at us from both sides. Glenn Beck runs up out here in North Jefferson County. We don't get any of that. We didn't know there's a outbreak in Leavenworth County at the public schools. Didn't know that. Well, some of the campuses there, college campuses, are freaking out. I'm not sure.
We're not freaking out. We're just cleaning up puke. That's just an everyday occurrence now. Puke. Cat litter. Yeah. It's just another day at the wonderful school district.
line one, you're open if you want to say anything.
He's like on H1N1. He's puking.
He's puking right now. He can't talk.
Listen for that. That's what he's doing. He's puking.
He's been on over an hour. I've had him on hold for over an hour.
Might fall asleep.
Yeah.
That's one of the things with the H1N1, you get fatigued and fall asleep. Yeah. You get fever, fall asleep, then you die.
Well, it's not lethal yet for my.
Here comes two of my surviving custodians. They're coming out here. Well, he just got over being sick.
Well, he should have the antibodies now. He sent him to the front lines, you know.
I'm going to go in here with him. Going in this disease-infested place.
Well, wait, are you working? Or are you off work or what?
I'm working. Can't you hear that damn thing going down the hallway? I want to work.
Well, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I mean,
not tell anything. We're just having fun here.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I'm talking to this one of my coworkers looking at me. I'm talking to a guy on a radio show.
Yeah.
Tell him about all the goddamn H1N1 we have around here.
Big flu.
Yeah, ones that we're saying we're dying. Not yet. You can't die yet. We got more puke to clean up. I got a real smart ass custodian here. He cleans that puke up with one of the owl scrubbers. You don't have to touch it.
That's smart. I don't know how you dump it, but I mean, you got it.
Got a big old inch and a half hose out where you dump it at. We just throw it outdoors. Let the cat get the cat take 21.
Cats come over and eat puke.
Oh, yeah. They eat food, eat the school cafeteria food. They'll eat that shit.
Maybe the cats will be start spreading it instead of pigs.
Cats don't good. Just pigs. Yeah. Pigs and people. Yeah. What a similarity, huh?
Well, it could be a hell of an interesting situation. We'll have to pay attention to our local news media and see if they cover the pig flu outbreak.
Oh, I ain't looking for the pig flu outbreak. They're going
to
sleep without any drug. Business as usual. I want God's panic.
They haven't really started handing out the shots yet. They want $20 a pop, I guess. If you really did, they're going to give the. You know, I wonder if janitors, custodians, I wonder if they qualify for the pig flu shot free.
Well, we're getting the hell out of here. It's time for us to quit. I'll give you a call back in a little bit.
I'm going to play a little music and play Bessie Smith. Black Mountain Blues, which is a lot about like that.
Back in Black Mountain, a child will smack your face. Back in Black Mountain, a child will smack your face. Babies crying for liquor and all the birds sing bass. Black Mountain people are bad as they can be. Black Mountain people are bad as they can be. They use his gunpowder just to sweeten their teeth. Homes in Black Mountain can't keep a man in jail. Homes in Black Mountain can't keep a man in jail. If the jury finds them guilty, the judge will go their bail. Black Mountain, sweetest man in town. And a man in Black Mountain, the sweetest man in town. He met a city gal and he throwed me down. I'm bound for Black Mountain, me and my razor and my gun. Lord, I'm bound for Black Mountain, me and my razor and gun. I'm gonna shoot him if he stands still and cut him if he runs. Down in Black Mountain, they all shoot quick and straight. Down in Black Mountain, they all shoot quick and straight. A bullet will get you if you start to dodge in too late. Got the devil in my soul and I'm full of bad blues. Got the devil in my soul and I'm full of bad blues. I'm out here for trouble, I've got the Black Mountain blues.
Nobody, Miss Mary, in this world to care for me.
No, but I ain't.
John Lee Hooker, Wandering Blues. Let's pick it up with a little bit of Count Basie and the Dirty Dozens from 1938. Back to music. I can't get a thing on the phone there. Here we go with Ella Fitzgerald, the Tisket a Tasket, the classic Tisket a Tasket.
A tisket, the basket. I lost my yellow basket. And if that girlie don't return it, don't know what I'll do. Oh dear, I wonder where my basket can be. Oh gee, I wish that little girl I could see. Oh, why was I so careless with that basket of mine? That itty bitty basket was the joy of mine. A tisket, a tasket. I lost my yellow basket. Won't someone help me find my basket and make me happy again, again?
Was it green?
No, 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 no.
Was it red?
No, 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 no.
Was it blue?
No, 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 no. Just a little yellow basket. A little yellow basket.
Yes. Ella Fitzgerald, a tisket, a tasket. What a great one. Now, have you been listening? NPR, National Public Radio, opened up this morning with an outrageous. Their two main lead stories was David Letterman. Yes, David Letterman being blackmailed by a CBS news, a CBS journalist who worked for 48 hours. Can you believe that? He's trying to get a job writing up a story. And he wanted $2 million from Dave Letterman. Now it's just too much money up there for the people to handle. Yes, that was the lead story, was David Letterman candidly admitting to screwing women, female members of his production staff for his huge nighttime television show. Yes, that's a big news there. And then it just goes on and on. Well, Roman Polanski, here he is, 75 years old, being drugged back in. You know, on the way, there was an article on the Counterpunch, Alexander Coburn writing. He said, thought sort of ironic here, dragging Roman Polanski back from Switzerland for doing something with some 13-year-old girl who's now 44, doesn't want anything done about it. And then we got David Letterman talking about how he's screwing his women and the production. It's just the media is really busy reporting on itself. I keep opening up this phone line and I can't get a answer.
Oh.
You're on air. How are you doing?
Hey.
We got 12 minutes. What's up? What's on your mind?
Well, are you talking about going back, or are you talking about David Letterman?
Well, it's all big media. It's big media, not we. I gave a bunch of people's news earlier about the G20 protests and the economic distribution or lack thereof of on the world, and now we're just basically talking about big media and David Letterman, I guess, admitting that he had sex with a couple women. He's being blackmailed out.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And Roman Polanski's coming back from he's going to be extradited back, I guess. He's going to come back to the United States. 75 years old. I didn't know Polanski was that old.
Yeah, he was married to Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
And
he's butchered. Butchered by hippies. Crazy hippies.
I wouldn't call them hippies. I just call them a bunch of lunatics. They probably had that H1N1.
So the media's been pretty busy. The big media's, it was a 24-hour or 48-hours guy who worked for the news magazine from CBS that was threatening to blackmail him. I thought it was amazing. Letterman, we're talking about Letterman. And, of course, Obama, Glenn Beck has been making a big deal about the two 747 jets that flew over to Copenhagen to try to bring the Olympics to Chicago, failed. And Obama comes back and has some light statement. Well, Glenn Beck points out that all the millions of dollars it was taken to go over there to get that. Glenn Beck is very busy destroying Obama on a daily basis. And he makes a big point out of anything that is a failure. Of course, they're wanting to fail. Rush Limbaugh said that. Rush Limbaugh said at the beginning, we want him to fail. And I think that's what's going on. It's just sort of destroying whatever they see as the immediate threat. Although Glenn Beck today announced, said that he was not supporting the Republicans. He's not a Republican or a Democrat. Of course, he seems to slam the Obama administration more than he does anything else in life. And I'm just amazed that big media, sort of having a nervous breakdown.
The media and Rush and Limbaugh are going to start their own party called the Asshole Party.
Could be.
Yeah. Come and join the Asshole Party.
That's not right.
I was watching on the news, I think it was MSNBC, they were talking about all the right-wingers getting everybody stood up about Obama and everything. What would happen if someone, took a shot at him? And the commentator from New Orleans, I can't remember his name, he's the bald-headed guy, wears the glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that would be a very, very, very major mistake. It's something he said I wouldn't even want to entertain what the repercussions would be. That's why I think if someone did it, that'd be the end of the Republican Party, because the blacks and the Democrats would be out looking for him.
That's very possible. It's quite a mess.
Well, of course it would. I mean, Jesus, come on. It's the right wing, the Republicans, the ultra-right. They call everybody else ultra-left if you don't agree with them.
Right.
The other ones are stirring all this up. I mean, Obama's doing nothing different than Roosevelt did back in the twilight of the Depression. He's doing nothing different. He's just trying to get social programs passed to help American people. And these capitalists. Now, I hate to have to say this because I'm going to have to swallow 20 years of arguing with my eldest brother about this, but. The capitalists that finally show their colors, and its colors are that the only thing they give a crap rat's ass about is how much green they can get in their pocket.
They're not really generous in throwing it down. The federal government bails out bankers. If you listen to the Dave Lindorf show of Radio Free Kansas, it's on the flyer. Dave Lindorf has been doing some intensive research, and he's pointing out that the inspector general for the TARP, program to bail out the bankers, the inspector general's pointing out he's having to fight to get them, Federal Reserve to allow him to audit them to find out just where the money went, to what bankers. And he's not talking about bailout programs, but he's talking this one particular one he's in charge of. But we're not good at that. There's a good possibility that this isn't going to help. I think I got an irate listener who didn't answer the line. Now he's calling me on air.
Well, the thing of it is that more people realize what's going on. That new Roger Moore movie, the Capitalism Love Affair, when he asked the former TARP regulator where the money went to, she just sort of stuttered, and finally she came out and said, well, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's a little
because they don't know where this money went to. A lot of it went to a lot of the CEOs' pockets of these bonuses.
Hello.
Yeah.
Is anybody there?
Yes, you're on air.
You guys are talking about media, and you're talking about capitalism, and you know Michael Moore's film just opened up today. Yeah, he's got a lot to say about capitalism.
Yes, we're going to see it. We were just talking about Michael Moore's new film.
You were?
Have you seen it yet?
Radio show?
Well, it's on the flyer, and have you seen it yet?
Yes, I just saw it today.
Tell me what you thought of it.
I thought it was excellent. This is the best movie he's ever made.
Huh.
And it's going to whip up the Glenn Becks of the world like you've never seen.
Man, watch it. They're probably taking shots at Michael Moore next.
I wouldn't doubt it. He basically straight up calls for socialism.
Really?
Yeah.
I've been monitoring Beck, and Beck is already, smearing Moore. He was doing that earlier this week.
Well, he's going to smear him a lot more now. This will fuel the teabaggers to where it's a conspiracy for sure, because Michael Moore just straight up comes out. He didn't say anything against Obama, but he blasts Reagan and Bush like you've never seen. And he, holds up FDR as the last hope that we had, and now he holds up Obama as another hope, but basically says that we need to basically end capitalism, because before it ends us, before we become another Argentina, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just spells it out. He shows the whole decade of the 80s, the 90s, and the last 10 years is just, just a total rape and pillage by the rich, by the super rich, 1% of the population. Raping the country and taking it down.
Well, we just have to believe in the Mayans. 2012, they'll be all over with, so what the hell?
I guess Michael Moore's a Mayan. Is that what we're going to be saying?
Now, hold on. I was listening to that custodian earlier. That's pretty funny.
Yes, that's very good. That was a great custodian. Buckets of puke, H1N1. That's an interesting. You wouldn't know it from the media around here. It's all Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh on AM radio.
God, it's sad.
Living in the heartland of the Republican, the stronghold of the Republican Party here. This is sort of like Nazi Germany when it was divided, when Nazi Germany was in the 1930s. Just trying to make Austria part of Germany. It's all divided. Rush Limbaugh is speaking to the people who are going to listen to him, in the heartland, and they got all these Fox News networks. Of course they're going to play him. They're right wing,
Bombing. It's like carpet bombing. They're, like I said earlier, the G20 protesters had to put up with these crazy noise weapons used in Iraq against demonstrators in Iraq.
Yeah, well, Michael Moore put out this email saying that the teabag nation ends today. He's taking it upon himself to declare that it ends today.
We've only got 2 minutes left for today's show, but he did say that he's opening in a record number of screens that he's never opened. I guess even 9/11, all of his other shows, his movies have never had this many screens.
So right. It's huge numbers of people going to it.
And he's gave like over a dozen cities that are hardest hit free tickets for a night. People can go in free. And there's all kind of benefits.
Yeah, last night there was a lot of theaters that showed it for free.
Mm-hmm.
It's hometown, Flint, Michigan. That's one of the hardest hit places in the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
He lays it out. It's like Wall Street is a big casino, and he shows Katrina footage and the devastations of homeowners. But then he also shows people rising up, like in Chicago when they took over the factories, when the homeowners in Florida took over the homes and the neighborhoods. And, basically just calling for everybody to rise up against all these reactionaries. And these emails, that's what he's talking about how this is the beginning of, he's hoping that it can stir up enough people to basically overturn all this right-wing rabid reaction that's been happening. He basically says that the theaters are going to be the real town hall meetings. He's just sick of the right wing reactionaries in the country. And
I'm on my last 30 seconds. I want to encourage you. I may schedule a Sunday program. Otherwise, get back with us Monday night. Thanks for we're going to do a proper media monopoly roast here later this week. I've got some hot interviews coming up I have to air on Afghanistan. I'll be happy to talk with people about that later. Thank you for calling in, gentlemen. Good night. This is Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadell, signing off. It is October 3rd, 2009. Good night.